Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
A very good Thursday morning to you. A privilege to have on the program a man I've known since 1989 when we served together at the basic school. We're actually battle buddies times one. We got mortared pretty good at Combat Outpost one day, and I used to store my Mountain Dew in his freezer when he was in a good mood and would let me do that. General John Kelly. First of all, sir, thank you very much for coming on today. It's a privilege to have you on All Marine Radio.
Good to be with you, Mike.
All right. So before we know that whether we can take you seriously or not, we need to know about you as a human being. So you're born and raised?
In Boston.
Oh, my God. You know what? I'm not
sure. In fact, Mike, I was just up there a couple of weeks ago. I was the keynote speaker. Boston had the first Vietnam Veterans Memorial in the country. That was about 40 years ago, 35, 40. And then just about a month ago, the same people that put together the Vietnam Memorial, only a generation separated, mostly cops and firemen up there, raised the money and just right on the waterfront dedicated the first in the nation war memorial to the Iraq and Afghanistan fallen. Really, really nice event. But yeah, I'm from Boston.
Oh, man. Absolutely killing me. Absolutely killing me. Everybody knows that not my favorite city in the country, and for whatever reason, God has punished me by keeping people of Massachusetts in my life constantly. And so we all have our crosses to bear. Born and raised here. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar as a young man?
Well, Boston now and back then were just a very, very, very Marine town. Of course, back when I first came in 1970, the Navy, my recollection, it was a big Navy town as well. There were probably 25 permanently assigned ships to Boston. Two aircraft carriers, Wasp, and I can't remember the other one, 20,000 probably sailors, just a station there. And anywhere there was a Navy base back in those days, it was a Marine barracks, so there were 1,400 Marines stationed in Boston at the Marine barracks there.
Wow.
But generally, very maritime town, but generally speaking, anyone with red blood in his veins would join the Marine Corps. And again, back in those days, we had the draft. So generally speaking, you waited until you got your draft notice. You went down, took your physical. In my case, I went down to see the recruiter before, and he just said, hey, I haven't got time to talk to you. Go take your draft physical. If you pass, talk to me. So that's what I did. But again, the neighborhood guys back in those days, and it's not much different today, once you passed your physical, no self-respecting guy would go in the Army, so you'd go in the Marine Corps. Back then, we had a two-year to compete with the draft, which was 2 years. We had a two-year enlistment in the Marine Corps. Generally speaking, you went right in the infantry, went to the Vietnam War. I did not, but go to the Vietnam War and then essentially go home. So that's how I, that's the beginning of my Marine Corps career.
Now, if my memory serves me correct, you also joined the Merchant Marine, yes?
Yeah, a year before that, I was kind of my year abroad. I wasn't the best student, in high school, and certainly wasn't the best student in college. So, I think I went to one semester, got into the second semester. I couldn't be less interested in school, so I went in the Merchant Marine for roughly a year, and that was literally a year abroad. It was just pretty good money, but that didn't matter as much as just going on ships and going to Asia and in Europe and the like. So. And then I got my draft notice. I remember I got into Seattle from a trip to the Far East, and I talked to my mom. Back in those days, this was before computers and before cell phones, and I called her as soon as I hit port, and she said, yeah, I got this letter from the draft board. So I said, go ahead and open it. And she opened it, and she said, you get a report for a physical. So that started my kind of Marine Corps career. I just hopped an airplane back to Boston. As I said, I went down to see the recruiter, and he said, go take your physical, and come back, see me. So that's what I did.
Best Liberty port as a merchant marine, as a merchant sailor.
You can never beat San Francisco, but if you talk about an overseas port, every one of them. There's sinful places in the world, Mike, and I managed to visit most of them.
San Francisco.
San Francisco is a great city. Yeah, I mean, very similar to Boston in size and whatnot, but it's just a. I'm not so sure it is anymore, but it was a lot of fun. And
no, it still is.
Back in the Haight-Ashbury period and all of that, you know, so it was a lot of
well, it was more fun then.
Music things going on, a lot of fun.
But my three favorite cities in the world are New York City, San Francisco, and Hong Kong. It's pretty similar, cosmopolitan places,
yeah.
Great food, great entertainment, beautiful places, and they all speak English.
Yeah, no, there's no I'm not a New York guy just because they're always beating up on the Red Sox, but as you know. But New York's a great town. In fact, probably my second favorite city in the States next to Boston.
All right. So you joined the Marine Corps. What year is that?
1970.
1970.
Went to boot camp in September 70, and I was an infantryman on 0311. It's interesting, was to me anyways, as I was getting close to retiring, my sergeant major, one of my sergeants major down at the Southern Command of Miami was a Marine. So I said to him kind of in September last year, I said, hey, see if they can use a, you know, during the graduations, they always have a senior officer usually from the staff down there at Parris Island. They usually have someone review the command as it, you know, the graduation, kind of oversee the graduation as the mm-hmm. official reviewing officer. So he set it up for late November. I went down there with my wife, my daughter, Kathleen, who is now engaged, was engaged then too, to a retired Marine Lance Corporal from Maine who lost a leg, got pretty banged up in Afghanistan, lost a leg, and they miraculously saved his other limbs. But and now is with the exception of the missing leg or the gone leg, he's in very good shape. Well, he was there. They were there with us as well. And as it turned out, and I knew this, I didn't tell anyone until we got there, but we spent the night with all of the recruit families, and then the next day I was a reviewing officer. And it just happened to be 45 years to the day that I graduated from boot camp. Same parade deck, same place, obviously Parris Island. So it was kind of neat for me.
45 years. Wow.
Yep.
Wow, well, I mean that's crazy. So you do your you go to boot camp Parris Island,
right?
And then do you get anywhere close to Vietnam? Do you get to Okinawa?
I had orders to it was the 1st Marine Division RVN or Republic of Vietnam. That was the key. That was the acronym. Everyone wanted RVN on their orders. And I had RVN on my orders to go there. So we, at the time, they sent you home in 30 days leave. And about 4 days into the leave, I get a telegram. I don't think we have those anymore, but I got a telegram from the Marine Corps. It said my orders were changed to the 2nd Marine Division, and I had 10 days leave. So I reported into Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 6th Marines in 19. I got there about... I got Christmas home, so right around the very first week of January 1971.
So you get to your squad. You're a rifleman. Were you a good rifleman?
I was perfect. It was incredible. I actually lucked out in terms of hitting the Marine Corps at exactly the right time because for promotion purposes because. The austerity plan under Richard right. Nixon was that he was going to freeze all federal pay raises, and that included the military. So somehow they could only promote people through a meritorious promotion process, the 2nd Marine Division when I was there, I think they got like three or four Lance Corporal or three or four PFC to Lance Corporal promotion, meritorious a month, same kind of thing for Corporal, and I think they had one a month for Sergeant. So I get the meritorious PFC out of boot camp, and then got meritorious Lance Corporal. I made Lance Corporal, I think meritoriously, but then I made Corporal and Sergeant meritoriously, so I was a Sergeant 16 months. So that was, and the guys I went through boot camp with, a few of them were in the company with me, they all came in and went out as privates. I don't mean to laugh, but That was, I don't know how much money President Nixon saved not giving us raises, but it worked out for me.
Just a quick, I had Phil Smith on the program on Wednesday, and so he was talking about, you know, we started talking about the racial issues and the drug issues in the Marine Corps at the time. Did you experience any of that at Camp Lejeune?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I would say that the Marines and the company were, they were 99% of them had just come from Vietnam. You know, we were a different Marine Corps back then, and I think in a lot of ways, the country today does realize, or maybe not so much today, it's history so long ago, but we really weren't, as a country, we had really turned our back on a lot of things, to include the Vietnam War, and the folks that were coming in were one or two groups. Myself, you know, get drafted, came in, but there are others that, you know, in my case, I didn't try to stay out, but there were an awful lot of people that were successfully staying out of the, you know, staying away from the draft, out of the armed forces, by, you know, BSing their way or getting, if they had a little money, getting some doctor to sign a piece of paper that they had flat feet or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It really was too bad because, you know, the most, in my view, the most fundamental responsibility, duty of any citizen is to protect the nation. We had a whole generation of kids that didn't want to do that, and frankly, it's now been outsourced in some respects to the all-volunteer force, something I would not change. It works very, very, very well. But so anyways, what kind of Marines do we have? I'd say the vast majority of the Marines in my company, Bravo Company, vast majority were high school dropouts. Very large percentage of them, I would say, were functionally illiterate. I spent a fair amount of time. I had essentially a high school education in a semester of college. I spent a fair amount of my time sitting on the edge of these were back in those days, open squad bays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one had any automobiles. You had one side of a wall locker. I could run down. I mean, when we went on Liberty, you could not own jeans. You had to have a college shirt. You had to have shoes, no shorts to go on Liberty out in Jacksonville. It was very, very restricted. No one had automobiles. The first time you started seeing people with automobiles were about staff sergeant. Myself and two of my buddies chipped in, and I bought a car for like $600, but they paid for the gas and the maintenance and the insurance. So it wasn't that you couldn't have a car. You just I think when I went in the Marine Corps, I made $119 a month.
Wow.
In today's money, that's probably, I don't know, $300 maybe.
Right.
So the first time in those days that you could really afford to do anything was about staff sergeant. And it's my recollection, you know, you used to have to get permission to get married.
Right.
And even if you got married, unless you were a corporal over four, it seemed to me, you couldn't draw BAQ assistance in housing, BAS, BAS in subsistence. And there was no housing at the bases for anyone that was below the rank of, you were not eligible for housing if you didn't have, if you weren't a corporal over four. So you just didn't, you know, no one was married. Very few people were married. And the ones that were, their families, you know, their wives stayed back and, you know, kind of wherever they were from. So it was a very different Marine Corps.
Right.
So the Marines were all combat veterans, on the troublesome side. Fair amount of I wouldn't say heavy drug or hard drug, but mostly marijuana, a little bit of the other stuff, but those guys didn't last long, just because, I mean, hard drug use is takes you down the wrong road pretty quickly. Racial problems, yeah. One of my closest friends was a black guy by the name of Ray Steptoe from New York. We were sergeants together, but you know, in public, you know, white guys went with white guys and black guys went with black guys. So, yeah, I mean, it was reflective of the country's problems at the time. And as I look back at it, I mean, a lot of, you know, I tell the story, Mike, you know, I grew up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood in Boston. I didn't know any people of another race. I didn't know any people that were Protestant. And my bunkie in boot camp was a African American from West Virginia, and again, I had no interaction with African Americans in my life until this guy. And not that you can become friends in an open squad bay at Parris Island, but I got to know him a little bit. And I remember our first mail call, and I was absolutely homesick, crushed that I didn't get a letter from home. And he didn't get a letter from home either, and I can remember him expressing the same feelings I had. And the first time it struck me, gee, they're the same as I am. He's got his little sister that he's wants to hear from, and his mom and his dad. And I, it was a huge revelation to me that we're all the same. And that's why I think in the armed forces, we don't, particularly today, we don't really have these issues to deal with, because, you know, it's essentially a colorblind society. It's a meritocracy for the most part, and there's very, very little drug use, you know, to speak of. I mean, there's some of it, but, you know, you kind of ferret those guys out. So anyways, that's my story. I went on too long.
No, on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio, General John Kelly, United States Marine Corps, recently retired, joins us, and we're talking to him about his career. How do you get to college?
When I was, again, I was on a 2-year enlistment. The officers in the company, to include my company commander, started to talk to me about becoming an officer. You know, they had no idea what my background was in terms of the neighborhood antics and the jackassery that I was involved in as a kid. But, and I was kind of undecided about it. They were really not pushing it, but they talked to me about it a lot. And my first sergeant, Joe Webb, I don't know why I remember his name, but first sergeant came in, and I won't go into the kind of flowery language, but he essentially said to me, "Yeah, you know, Kelly, the way I feel about officers and lieutenants," he said, "but you know what? You'd make a good one. Not like them boys. You'd make a good one, and you ought to think about doing it." So I was actually involved in the process of that would take me to ROTC somewhere, and about July, I get out in September, went in in September. I guess it was June, my dad called me and said my mother, who was had been in remission from cancer, he called me and said she's it's back and it's not looking good. And so I decided not to go into one of these more formal programs, to go home, close to home. And so, but the day I left Camp Lejeune to drive home, my company commander said to me, he gave me the name of a guy by the name of Phil Ray. Phil Ray was a captain in the Marine Corps, a buddy of my company commander, and he was the OSO. He was the officer recruiting guy in Boston. And he gave me his telephone number, and he said, "Call this guy." This is Labor Day weekend. He said, "Call this guy and come to stay in the Marine Corps." So it was Tuesday morning after Labor Day, and it was about 8 o'clock in the morning. My mother come up and said, "Hey, there's a guy on the phone wants to talk to you. He says he's a captain in the Marines." So I went downstairs, and, you know, again, this is before he was in a phone booth somewhere. And he said, "Hey, Kelly, you know, Sergeant Kelly, I thought you were going to give me a call." And that that day I signed the paperwork for the PLC program. So I did the platoon leaders course, PLC, for 2 summers. And I was back in 1975.
Talk to me about, we'll talk about your career here in a minute, but give me two people that had a huge impact throughout on you in terms of your career.
In terms of my career, let me start with, and go backwards. I mean, I had my division commander, Charlie Wilhelm, who is a retired 4-star.
Right.
But when I was, a major, I went to 1st Marine Division, and General Wilhelm had just taken command of the 1st Marine Division, and I had been assigned to the 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion, 1st LAR, and I was a major and had that battalion, I think, probably 6 months as a major. And he was just a guy that... you know, I was a major, and of course, you never think you're going to make. If you're lucky, you think you're going to make a lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anyone that thinks, well, first of all, anyone that thinks you're going to make the next rank or beyond the next rank is probably a little bit more of a careerist than we can stand in the Marine Corps. So I never, as I looked at General Wilhelm, I never thought, well, that's what I'll be. That's what I want to be when I'm a major general. But it was more that's what I want to be when I grow up. And he just has been a mentor to me ever since then. I'll go back to my earlier years. I met a guy by the name of Vic Taylor, retired as a lieutenant colonel. Vic Taylor. I've known a lot of really good Marines. I could probably come up with a few more names, but he was my at the basic school. He was my tactics instructor for a patrolling instructor, and of course I'd been prior enlisted infantry guy, so I kind of knew the tactical ropes. And he was someone I said I want to be just like him when I grew up. He was just, you know, cool, calm, collected, unbelievably knowledgeable. Treated lieutenants exactly the way lieutenants ought to be treated. In fact, a better way to put it, he treated subordinates, we happen to be his lieutenants, the way you should treat your subordinates, as a mentor, as a guide, as someone who thoroughly enjoys working with junior Marines. We don't always see that. But so those two guys, I think, there were others, but those two, I think, would be the two that come to mind right away. And, of course, Vic Taylor remained a lifelong friend. He was a... If you know what the Battle of Dido is, he was in 3-4 and earned the Silver Star, and he's just a phenomenal, phenomenal man. And I'm still in contact with him.
You know, I have a story for you from your change of command as at first LAR. So, I mean, we served together, and so General Kelly's change of command at first LAR, and they have everything out there on a big football field, I think, and he got up to speak, and he's talking, he's thanking everybody. And it was a great day because, you know, there's a lot of guys that we had worked with at the basic school in IOC that were there, so you get to see your friends, and it's kind of fun. And he's standing up and talking. He said, and I need to thank the key wives. And he said, and he said,
oh, yeah, yeah. I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
This is one of the great recoveries of all time. And this is verbatim. He said, I'd like to thank, no, this isn't verbatim, but I'd like to thank Umpty France and Umpty France. And I'd like to say, and this is a quote, Priscilla Presley. And then I'd like to take Ann Taylor. And he keeps talking. And all of a sudden he stops and he says, did I say Priscilla Presley? Well, her name is actually, and I can't remember her name, but he says her real name, and he said, but come to think of it, having Priscilla Presley around here would have been pretty interesting.
Yeah, her name was Priscilla. She was the wife, great, great young lady, the wife of the battalion FAC. His call sign was Hose. I can't remember other than that, but good guy.
One of the great, great recoveries of all time. I've never forgotten it after all these years. Talk about the tours that impacted you. Obviously, in 45 years, you've been a lot of places, done a lot of things, but tours that had a profound and lasting impact on you.
It really goes without saying. God, they've all been good tours, Mike. I've never had a bad tour. Obviously the ones that were command tours. I mean, I had three companies. I had a company as a second lieutenant for a while, then a first lieutenant. Then I had two companies when I was back to the fleet as a captain, battalion. I was on sea duty on USS Forrestal. And if you would ask me a third name of someone who had profound impact, I'd tell you a major retired Ed Wells, who I knew in 2-2, my first battalion, and then we served together. He was a CO of the Marine Detachment on board Forrestal. This is back in the day when the nuclear, when the battalions, not the battalions, the aircraft carriers all had nuclear weapons on them. They don't anymore. I mean, they could be put back on, and they had the Marines, about 50 to well, about 70 Marines on board to guard the nuclear weapons. He taught me. I know this isn't your question, but he taught me really from the day I reported in to the importance of reading and studying. I remember he, words to the effect, said, it's a moral imperative for a leader to study the art and science of war because your men's lives depend on it. I took that seriously, and as you know, I'm a reader. But so all of my command time, the sea duty time, was pretty different, to say the least, for an officer. I served on two aircraft carriers, actually, Forrestal and Independence. They're both gone now. I got to tell you, the time I spent at the basic school in IOC, I taught for a while on the basic school staff. I was the head of offensive tactics, and then was selected to go for about 30 months to the infantry officer course. That was phenomenal. The people I got to work with the exception of you, but all of them were just superb officers. And, you know, again, I've had many, many hundreds of the students that went through tell me that, you know, the way we treated them and the way we taught them was, you know, profoundly important and impactful in their lives. So I could say as I go through my career, I was assigned duty as the commandant's liaison to Capitol Hill. That was an incredibly fascinating tour about, you know, for 4 years, extended twice, by General Krulak, who was a great mentor as well. 4 years nonstop working on the Hill. Never took a day off, a day's leave. I was gone because of the congressional travel. They tend to travel over, like, Thanksgiving, Christmas, that kind of thing.
Right.
But we made a real difference in terms of explaining the Marine Corps message to Congress, and from that, getting what the Commandant's priorities were. Much of the stuff we're flying today, we're flying because of Chuck Krulak putting an emphasis on that, and then we took it to the Hill, and you know, of course, it's illegal to lobby, but to just bring the Commandant's message to the Hill. But that was an absolutely fascinating tour. And a similarly fascinating tour was as a three-star working for Secretary Gates for 6 months and then Secretary Panetta for 18 months. And, you know, at the highest level of the U.S. government and how decisions are made and not made. But to have been involved in every meeting, with the exception of the White House, every meeting, telephone call, get-together, that those two gentlemen attended during the 2 years I worked for. It was an absolutely fascinating time. Combat time, you know, being the ADC, Assistant Division Commander, 1st Division under Jim Mattis, just an incredible experience. And then, of course, being there as the one MEF forward commander myself was, you know, a lot of tremendous times, a lot of, you know, real losing Marines. Sucks. Sending them home banged up. It's pretty bad. But, boy, I was never so impressed with the Marine Corps until I saw those boys and girls in combat. Just something to see.
If I asked you to put that into words, could you do that?
Put what?
What it's like to watch them every day in combat.
Total disbelief. I mean, I would see them, you know, particularly, you know, when there was combat going on, when they were shooting, firing, I was never, ever not amazed, no matter how many times I saw it, that when every instinct in your body says, don't make yourself a target, stay down, get behind the wall, don't go forward, you know, find a hole and cower in it and cry, they don't. It just never, it always caught my attention when I would see them move to the sound of the guns. And with the skills they have, it's second nature to them. I mean, we really, as a Marine Corps, should be proud of how well we train them and how confident we make them. But, boy, to see them go at it. But I think, Mike, disbelief. They make, you know, what was the expression? Common valor was a common virtue or something. But they, right. They redefined courage, you know, and when they went down, God. So sad, and the sadness in the little groups when they would lose one of their guys or gals, it was really, really something. But then they just kind of cry it out a bit, suck it up, you know. Some whoever the squad leader is, platoon sergeants, tells them to get up, saddle up, you know. Can't cry in our tears here. Let's get going, and they're right back at it. I don't know why, but we do something to them at boot camp and in Quantico.
Absolutely. It's always interesting that the answer I get to that question, sir, because, and it's always along the same vein in terms of, literally takes my breath away to try to explain the courage and selflessness that you see every day with these young men and women and risk their lives for each other, you know. And then you ask them later, what the hell were you doing? Well, sir, I knew he needed help, and I had to, and I went, and I wasn't doing anything I didn't think I was supposed to be doing. And, just incredible. I want to talk to you about, And if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you about something you said at your son's funeral, if you don't mind. The first thing you said that you took great solace knowing that this is where your son wanted to be. And as somebody, I told this, I've quoted you in terms of when people ask me about how do I feel about that both my sons are lieutenants in the Marine Corps. And I said, well, let me quote General Kelly, you know, who lost a son. And he said, look, this is I know this is where he wanted to be. And and I've often said that, you know, Marines, if you could have told them, hey, something bad's going to happen today. We're not going to tell you what, but something bad's going to happen. You can stay here if you want to. There would be never be any doubt that they would stay behind. Hey, your parents are going to be here. You could stay back here. Hey, no, no, no. Look, I'll see my mom and dad later. I need to go do this. Talk to us about that feeling, you know, as a parent who's lost a son and how you find comfort in that.
I've actually said this in remarks I've made in the last 5 years or so. I mean, one of the things that we as a family would do when I was stationed here in Washington during the, you know, since 9/11, get up to Bethesda, now Walter Reed Bethesda, pretty regularly. I'm probably, you know, in the neighborhood of about 200 times. And some of those times with guys like Secretary Gates, who went up frequently, Secretary Panetta, who went up frequently, but a couple of hundred times, at least a couple of dozen funerals over at Arlington. And as I've spoken, I mean, I just could never you go into the hospital room, and you see a Marine laying there, a Navy doc, one of our precious Navy docs. Laying in bed, all banged up, you know, missing limbs, 1, 2, 3 limbs, missing a face, missing side of a head. I mean, all burned like you couldn't believe, although most of the burn injuries went very quickly down at Brooke Army, down at the Burn Center in San Antonio. But you go in the room, and the parents would naturally be just absolutely stunned. They didn't know which way was up. And one of the reasons I went up so much was to see them early on, and then I'd give them a card and say, look, you know, there's going to be a miracle worked here, and your son or your daughter is going to work most of the miracle, but the medical people up here will work the rest of it. And I said, I know it's very hard to imagine right now, given where he is right now, but in a month from now, you won't believe the change. In 6 months from now, you won't believe the change. So just hang tough. And of course, I went up there so much, typically 3 days a week, sometimes, certainly the holidays, Karen and I would go up. Kate, my youngest, Kathleen, ultimately got a job at Walter Reed, working with the wounded guys and their families, and she worked there 4 years. So she, you know, sorry from that end of it. But, you know, the one thing you got to think when you look down and see someone that banged up is, I can't imagine this. Can't imagine being this kid's mother, father, whatever. And the kind of people they were just salt of the earth, just wonderful, wonderful people. And I could tell you a couple of interesting stories. They're just the best. But then, it was unimaginable. And then the funerals, of course, you can't even begin to imagine that. And I would tell you I was right. I could not imagine how bad it was until Joe Dunford, who is currently the chairman of the Joint Staff, came to the house one very early in the morning. And it was funny. It was the day before the Marine Corps birthday, and I was leaving the house at 6 o'clock over in the Navy Yard in Washington, and he was standing there in service alphas, and I thought, first thought that came to mind was, this isn't Marine Corps birthday, and then I thought to myself, even if it is, what is he doing here? And right. And then I knew. So
you knew?
Then I just knew. He didn't have to tell me, although he did tell me. You know, he's been a real official.
Right.
And of course, you know, we're very, very close friends over the years.
You bet.
So then, you go into the, you're waiting for the remains to come back, and then ultimately to bury over in Arlington. We buried them all over in Arlington, and the one thing you keep asking for is, why the hell did this happen? And as I say, Mike, it came to me, you know, that didn't matter what I thought. He was obviously doing what he wanted to do, and he was exactly in that place. I had an interesting, he would call us. As 3-5 was getting pretty banged up, and he would call or email us and say, hey, this guy that belongs to me just got hit, you know, can you check on him? We were up the hospital quite a bit, lieutenants, as they say, big country west. He lives down in Georgia now. Lost a leg in an eye. James Beidler, both legs above the knee. He's finished. Went to New York University, got a master's degree, works as a stockbroker up there now. We're still in contact with him and his wife. But
so there's a great picture of Beidler doing rehab, and for those of you who have never seen it, he's got high above the knee amputations, and you see him with this determined look on his face going up these stairs doing his physical therapy, and you look at that. In fact, it's on my computer right now. And you look at that and you think, you know what? And that whole phrase, where do we get these guys?
Yeah.
You know, where do we get these guys? And I'll never forget that picture or that kid. What a tough kid. And wow.
Okay. Yeah. One of the ones, Robert Daft, that we go check on, his FO was 81s, but he was also his RDFO. He's a Lance Corporal, 19-year-old. We're still, again, very close. In fact, we'll go to his wedding in Minnesota in October. But he was in ICU, and I happened to be in uniform, and I was always in uniform, I guess. And his parents were there, typical, you know, just, again, the deer in the headlight looks like, what the hell. And I said, told him who I was. He was very sedated, but not so much that he didn't understand. He grabbed me by the arm, and he said, sir, you got to get to Lieutenant Kelly. You got to call him. You got to tell him to stop. You got to tell him to stop going on every patrol. He doesn't have to. He said, sir, he's living on luck. It won't last forever. And about 3 days later, Robert was killed.
Wow.
And again, if you're a Marine and you hear those words, you know that probably the best word, you know, you would never want those words to lead to death. But if someone ever said that about Mike McNamara or John Kelly, I'd be pretty darn impressed, particularly if it was a 19-year-old combat veteran from Minnesota. So that's what that's all about.
My guest this morning is General John Kelly. We're talking about his career and combat deployments and now just got a new job and want to talk to you about that, sir. So much in the news is and I'll read it. One of the Marine Corps' most admired generals in recent memory has taken the reins of the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation. So first of all, congratulations and tell us about your new job.
Well, I don't know if your listening ship, your listening viewers, so to speak, know much about it, but you know it's essentially the foundation that was established some years ago to then raise funds and build the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Quantico. So it's the Marine Corps Museum, if you will. I was asked by the former chairman of the board, General Boomer. Retired four-star, former he was the ACMAC, Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps when he retired. And, of course, before him, you know, he's of my generation, he's quite a bit more senior to me growing up, but he was one of those walk-on-water guys everyone wanted to be like. And then before him, General Ron Christmas retired as a three-star Navy Cross in Way City. And these guys, who I don't even know really who started it, but they raised the money, and it's the current president and CEO of the museum is Rusty Blackman, who's a retired three-star, been a friend of mine since we were both captains almost. He's the day-to-day guy. He does everything from manages the thing to raises most of the money to supervises the construction and all that. And he does all the work anyways. And of course, like in business anywhere, he reports to a board. So the board is, and this is a very, very good board, certainly in the world we live in, a very prestigious board. There's no compensation to the board. I wouldn't take a nickel for something like this.
Right.
But the foundation is in the museum heading into a new phase. The current construction project that will essentially, I think, double the size of the museum, it will be completed in 2017. And that will be focused on the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. So that's, if you've been to the museum, plan another trip once the other wing opens up, particularly if you're a veteran of those wars, because they're going to do a great job. So after that, you know, of course, the decision and the board will decide in its time what's next. Are there more construction projects, or do you just continue raising money for other reasons. You know, one of the things that we were kind of discussing was, you know, how do you, in a sense, bring the Marine Corps Museum to the rest of the world or the rest of the country? And
you stood up and said, "All Marine Radio, of course. That's how we do it."
That's right. Yeah, there you go. But there's ways to do it. There's, you know, student groups. There's I know already the foundation finances things like writing and essay contests and things like that. And it is a very, very, very visited site anyways, and is one of the become a pretty regular site for just general tourists, whether they've ever been in the Marine Corps or not. But in a lot of ways, the beauty, and I'll kind of steal General Blackman, Rusty Blackman, who's the, again, present CEO, his kind of words, and that is that, the Marine Corps, the Marines, not the Marine Corps, and you got to know this is separate, this foundation is separate and needs to be from the Marine Corps. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of collaboration, but it's just a legal separation that's required. The museum is owned by the Marines. Every one of us that's alive, and every one of us that ever served, and it just keeps the legend of the Corps. And so much of the money was raised, you know, kind of a buck at a time from Marines and former Marines and Navy docs that served with us. And it is a phenomenal facility, and I can't wait to see what comes next for it.
You know, sir, when we took our kids to D.C., the first time we went as a family, I want to say probably in 2008 or 2009, but it was after the museum had opened. And so the kids thought, we got to go to D.C. for Dad, because we were on our way to New York City to see the Red Sox and the Yankees play. And so they had a great time in D.C., and the highlight of it was the, you know, we're going to go see the museum for Dad. There's so much interactive stuff in that thing.
Yeah.
It's where kids can, you know, run around and look at stuff, and, you know, they can put packs on, they can watch movies, the dioramas. But if you've never been, you have to put it on your bucket list, and you need to take your kids, because it's an absolutely incredible place. And if you, and really what you should do is you should go, you know, you can spend the whole day there, but you need to see it at night. Because,
yeah.
And that's the reason we're Catholics, and that's the reason I call it the cathedral.
Yeah, right.
And then, standing in the cathedral, watching my number two son, Patrick, be commissioned by a buddy of ours, Dave Furness, was a commanding general there, standing next to Chris Bronzi, a battle buddy from Ramadi in 2004. And also he was with us in Afghanistan, sitting there looking up at the quotes from General Shoup from Tarawa, in this hollowed, beautiful place, just an incredible experience. But if you've never been, you've got to go. And
yeah, when I was on active duty, I think at least six times, because they do the Officer Candidate School, OCS, commissioning there, and as you say, inside the cathedral. I've done that five or six times. I know they have weddings. They have other ceremonies. I know when I was in my last tour in Iraq, 2008, the two young guys at Station Nasser there, you know, Jordan Herder and Jonathan Yale.
In the painting, right?
Say what?
There's a famous painting of them too, as well. Yes, sir.
Yeah, and they were both killed, of course, standing their ground in protecting the Marines and the Iraqi personnel that were inside the little base. But I know when, and they were both killed. But when the Secretary of the Navy gave them gave the families their Navy crosses, it was done there in the hall. So it's taken on a little bit of a life of its own, as I say. It's still very much under construction, but I've seen and been briefed on what the thrust of the exhibits will be and all that. And as you point out, Mike, there'll be an opportunity to kind of experience it, you know, interactive, as well as just having the exhibits, you know.
Awesome. No, it's great, sir. And relative to that, I mean, so how much input do you get? How much do you get to get your hands on a rudder and steer it in your new capacity?
Yeah, I mean, the board meets a couple times a year. Usually, in fact, one of the two meetings they do here in Quantico, and then it's associated with the awards they give out. This year, the number one recognized guy, there were a lot of awards, was Senator Warner. who's retired, you know, former Secretary of the Navy, but more importantly, former enlisted Marine and Senator here from the Commonwealth of Virginia, who's just a terrific guy. So, but two board events a year, and the staff, there's a staff here in Virginia that then bring the various decisions that have to be made. There's read-aheads and this kind of thing, and then they bring the various decisions to the board. And so at that board meeting, whatever the decisions are, of course, the board speaks based on recommendation from the staff, General Blackman, and then we're off to the races. So individually, not. I mean, it's a democracy, so to speak. So
I've got an email that somebody sent me yesterday when I had said you were coming on. Mac, would be curious to hear what General Kelly has to say about what he believes is the most interesting thing at the museum. So, sir, what do you find the most interesting at the museum?
Yeah, I'd say the overall, the overall theme of it, and this wouldn't surprise, I don't think, most people that have been in the Marine Corps know Marines. The overall theme, it's about Marines and about our Navy docs that serve with us. It's not about generals. God knows it's not about generals and shouldn't be. It's not about really individuals. It's about this incredible group of men and women called, the Marine Corps, who just do things because of the ethos. So that's the kind of overall theme that certainly caught my attention. And then, the focus obviously on how different we are, everything from at the very beginning, as you remember, the boot camp kind of thing all the way up through. I mean, I got to tell you, we do it right. We do it right at Parris Island in San Diego. We do it right at OCS in the basic school. We are different for that in a much better way for doing that and having this one single experience at the entry level for the enlisted and the officers. And, of course, then we are, to say the least, never forget those that came before us. And again, the emphasis, I'm a big reader, and I get into a real heavy World War II reading, just kind of reading a lot of things. I get into it a few years ago, the Atkinson books, the trilogy on war, Army at Dawn was they're really, really good books about the United States Army during World War II, and definitely worth a read. But as I get more and more into that, it went on for a couple of years, and I'm sometimes a book a week guy. I started looking for leaders, and the number of books to read written by general officers back in those days, it was the Army Air Corps, and the Navy. Very, very large number of books written as memoirs by general officers from those services. Very few, on the other hand, written by general officers. Marine general officers, and the ones that were written, there's a very different thrust in the book. It's more about the Marines. And again, I think that says a lot to who we are and why we are as good as we are.
You know what? Being the moderator of this show, we talk a lot of shit about the Marine Corps. And, people that are civilians that listen, they'll email and say, you guys really like yourself. But if you've been around, and General Kelly, I don't know too many guys who served longer than you have in terms of 45 years. We don't talk shit for no reason. We're being modest when we say we're pretty good. When you watch us locate, close with, and get after somebody's ass, we do that like nobody, and we will stay there until it's done. There's not one bit of quit in the Marine Corps. And then you pile that on top of our uniform standards, the fact that we're the only service that has a belt. You draw your own conclusions from that, right? We have the toughest boot camp, right? And then we have the best museum. Everything that when you look at Marine Corps and what the Marine Corps stands for, it's a unique corporation, and it is about being the best, and every time you turn the corner, and I don't care if you go to the new museum down at MCRD in San Diego, I don't care if you go see a battalion parade or a boot camp graduation, what you see is the best and an emphasis on the best, and the museum, without question, is a commitment to the best. I'll tell you my favorite that I absolutely love is the whole landing at Iwo Jima, and when the ramp goes down and you see the flag there.
Yeah.
That's the no shit flag, one of the two.
Yeah. Yep.
That is the flag that they put up on that island, for God's sakes. And that is almost, you know, mythological in terms of looking at it and going, that's what those guys put up.
Yeah.
So I want to switch gears with you. I want to talk about current events in the Marine Corps. First of all, your thoughts on post-combat related mental health. Two questions for you. First question, is it okay on active duty? Are we doing enough? Can you put your hand up? Can you go to mental health? Will it have any professional repercussions for you? So Marines on active duty, have we done enough? Is it okay?
Well, first of all, there's no question the outreach is, if you need help, and we're not only asking the question, we're trying to identify people that need help, but if you need help, get it. But I would tell you that I think one of the things that works against us as Marines, it's the same in the other services to a degree, depending on what branch and whatnot, is this sense that we're all supermen or superwomen, and I'm okay, you blow it off. That's why, I'm never so impressed when I see in Iraq the kind of care that the sergeants and the staff sergeants and lieutenants wear, how well they knew their men and women, and knew when they were having a difficult time dealing with something and maybe say, hey, you know, it's time for you to sit it out for a few days. It's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of you need a little bit of a break. I think I once talked to a number of psychiatrists about mental health issues and about suicide, because it is a national tragedy. I mean, I lost a son. My wife and I and our family lost a son, but boy, we have just incredible pride. You know, I cannot imagine what it would be like to lose a son or a daughter from something like suicide or a DUI incident or something like that. But anyways, in trying to get our arms around the suicide issue, and Mike, we've tried so hard, and you know that.
Right.
Talking to the psychiatrist, I remember having this, I guess I was about ready to go overseas to for my last tour in Iraq, and several psychiatrists said, do we have any idea at the end of the day? Because if you know what causes it, then you can know how you'd know how to prevent it. And we'd been talking about it and studying it and all that. And I said to the psychiatrist, do we really have any idea why someone does this? And I said, no, sir, we don't really know. I said, have you ever prevented one? I don't know. I know that this is them talking now. I know that I had people who talked about suicide and under my care never committed suicide. I know I had people under my care that never talked about suicide. I didn't think for a second they'd commit suicide, and they committed suicide, and I was shocked. Our junior enlisted people, our junior leaders try, but at the end of the day, it just seems like it's an impossible thing to predict. But we shouldn't stop trying. Everyone that comes back from overseas is a little bit disjointed. I've heard people make the case that, you know, maybe in modern society people have, you know, fewer effective kind of emotional shock absorbers because we come more from a society that's pampered and all that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. There might be something to that. We didn't really recognize this problem as much back, and you can just imagine the guys, you mentioned Iwo Jima, you know, no one that was on that island, nobody, didn't have a lifelong struggle with what they'd seen, you know, but back in those days it was, you know, you get out of the Marine Corps, get out of the service, and then, you know, same applied for Normandy and places like that, and you just kind of sucked it up and went back to work, and you can just imagine the number of people who ended their own lives or just drank themselves, self-medicated. So,
you know, sir, I interviewed a man, his name's Cal Humphrey, 91-year-old PFC on Iwo Jima last week. Wound up becoming a squad leader, and then was wounded on the 19th day of the battle. And, you know, he said, Mac, you've heard that, you know, people will ask, like, well, why didn't you, my son asked me, why don't you ever talk about it? He said, what the hell am I going to tell him? that, you know, that I didn't brush my teeth for a month and I wore the same clothes. I brushed my teeth with the same toothbrush that I cleaned my rifle, that I wiped my ass with my hand, and the lava sand was great on Iwo Jima because you could get that stuff off your hand pretty easily, that I sat there and watched guys bleed to death in my fighting hole, and the only thing I could do was give them a shot of morphine. You know, who would I tell that to? My mom? No, I never tell that to my mom. You know, my dad never asked me, and I sure as hell wouldn't share it with my kids. He said, so I came home, I went back to work, I send the Legion money, but I never go in those places because I don't want to go back there. And, you know, so that generation, he would never, ever, I mean, he would consider it impolite to bring it up to his parents, to his brothers and sisters, and burden them with his, you know, his cross. And so just...
Well, and what you've just explained, the examples you just gave, those are the easy ones. Right. The other ones are what many of us have had to do to another, a fellow human being, even though we, you know, categorize them as an enemy. Terrorist or something. The fact is, what we did have to do terrible things to other human beings, legal, but we had to do them. And then, of course, how do you tell someone that your best friend just got turned into, you know, a kind of a red mist all of a sudden because of an IED? Mm-hmm. You can't even begin to talk about those things. Mm-hmm. So but back to your original question, I would say this. I think there is and has been for a number of years a sincere attempt on the part of the institution, Marine Corps and Army in particular, and then, of course, within the other services, some of the more combat organizations have the same outreach. SOCOM, Special Operations Command, does good stuff on this, and that is to really help people, identify people who are struggling and get them the help they need. You know, the good news is most of us, after a period of time, you know, we deal with it. You're never the same, but you deal with it. The bad news is we still have a few that struggle terribly, but I would have to say I have confidence when I say that just because you step forward and say, hey, I'm having a problem, doesn't mean that the institution is going to put you aside and you're not going to be able to stay in or whatever. I think quite the contrary, I think.
The my guest, General John Kelly. We have him for a few more minutes, and another question about post-combat related mental health. For guys who've got out, sir, and they've tried to plug into the VA, and they've got frustrated, and the constant complaint you hear or that I hear is they're more than willing to medicate me, but I don't want to be medicated. I want somebody to help me. Do you have a message for those guys?
Keep trying. Just keep trying.